And now, from the Green 960 studios in San Francisco, this is an organic conversation with Helga Hellberg and Mark Mulcahy.
And welcome to this week's edition of An Organic Conversation, a show about food, relationships, and life itself. We're your hosts, Helga Hellberg.
And Mark Mulcahy.
Thank you for all the questions and comments that we've received. Wayne from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, comments on our show, May I Be Frank, among several other people that wrote us with their thoughts and comments on that show. Wayne writes, we are avid listeners of your show, and we were very moved when Frank Ferrante shared his story with you on the air. I know you have talked about the concept of nourishment beyond food many times in the past, but somehow during that particular show, we got it. Thank you for your weekly dose of poetry, wisdom, stories, and expertise far beyond food. It's very much appreciated. Thank you, Wayne from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mark, I don't think we've ever had a comment from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Yeah, and I've been there several times. It's a great town.
I know you have.
It's a great town, yeah.
What is it like?
Well, it's an old, that's where a lot of breweries were from.
Oh, that's why, of course. Yeah, great.
Yeah, they were a big German population, obviously, because that's where beer came from, right?
It's right at the lake.
Yeah. Well, no. But they've got a great baseball stadium there.
Of course.
They've got great co-ops there. The Outpost Co-op is there. I've been there. I've taught some management seminars there. Milwaukee's a great town. It's got an old downtown. It's got a nice feel to it.
Isn't that in Wisconsin where the Farm Aid concert?
Yeah, they were there. The first week of October. So a little over a month ago, they were there. The 25th anniversary of Farm Aid.
And every year, Farm Aid, a big show, a big concert with acts like Willie Nelson, Neil Young,
John Mellencamp, yeah, Dave Matthews,
to benefit family farming.
Yeah, benefit family farming. They've been doing it for 25 years.
Go Wisconsin. Check it out, Farm Aid. And again, thank you, Wayne. That was indeed a beautiful show, May I Be Frank, 6 weeks ago, about on the transformation through food and beyond food. May I Be Frank. You can look that up in our archives on anorganicconversation.com. Mm-hmm. You're listening to An Organic Conversation here on Green 960. I'm Helga Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we are very excited about our guests today, farmers and activists for the earth and their fellow farmers. More on that when we come back right after the break. And we're back here to An Organic Conversation as part of The Green Morning, an entire morning dedicated to your health. Holistic nutrition, eco-travel, food advocacy, The Green Morning, every Saturday from 9 to 12:30 here on Green 960. For more information, visit thegreenmorning.com. I am Helga Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today we are talking about an entire sustainable family, Del Cabo. With us in the studio is Larry Jacobs, president and founder of Jacobs Farm Del Cabo, and Sandra Bellin, co-founder of Del Cabo, a cooperative of organic growers that addresses not just environmental sustainability, but social and economical responsibility as well. Thank you both for coming to the studio today.
Thanks for inviting us.
Great to have you.
Thank you.
You've been farming for, 25, 30 years?
We're 1980, 30 years.
Wow. Tell us the scenario. What made you find each other and then go on this path of becoming organic farmers? Larry, why don't you start?
I got hit by an event that I wouldn't call it tragic, but it moved me. I had a tree nursery in the San Fernando Valley, just north of Los Angeles. I was growing pine trees and some citrus and a few oak trees. It was a wholesale tree nursery. And in those days, you had to have a nursery license. And the nursery license required an inspection by the county ag inspector periodically. So the county ag inspector was an elderly gentleman, from my perspective back then, who would regularly visit. And usually it was a cordial thing, and we'd talk, he'd look at the plants. And on this particular visit, he found an insect infestation. It was an aphid infestation, which is a small plant-sucking insect. And he told me that I'd have to get rid of the insects or not be able to continue selling the plants, that it was illegal to sell them with insects on them.
How old were you at that point?
I was
in your 20s.
Late teens, early 20s.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, well, it's great. So how do I do? What do I do? And he invited me. He said, well, come on over to my house. And so I followed him in a little green Datsun pickup to his house, and he opened up his garage door. And there was this aroma, rich aroma, come out of his garage, and he had a little side business going, selling pesticides. And he pulled down from the shelf this one-gallon jug, brown glass, skull and crossbones, Metasystox. It was a pretty strong pesticide. And he said, this will do it. So that was going to be the solution to the problem. I jumped back in a little pickup, drove back to the nursery. It was a 9,500 degree day in the San Fernando Valley. Had my cutoffs on, you know, no shirt, barefoot. Got a little backpack sprayer on the way and began spraying this pesticide. It wasn't too long after where I began feeling dizzy, nauseous, and semi-passed out.
So your nursery at that point was not organic, or was it?
No. The word organic didn't exist
sure.
at that time.
Yes.
This would have been
1971,
you know, 60s, 70, 71, 72, something like that. And I had such a strong reaction to this pesticide that I couldn't even conceive of opening the bottle again, and began looking for other ways of dealing with the aphid problem. And I don't remember now how I found a man by the name of Everett Dietrich. Deke is a old-time entomologist who does biological control. He started an insectary, a place that raises insects that are sold to gardeners and farmers to help control other insects that are problems.
They sell the good bugs.
They sell
basically to keep the bad bugs in check.
Right, the good insects, bugs being an order. And he came out of the UC Riverside system. He was a grad student getting his PhD at the time when he was offered a position in the UC Riverside to run their biological control lab. He thought that was the ultimate job, so didn't finish his PhD program. And anyway, short story is I found Deke. He suggested lace wings. He sent me some lace wings, and he also said, you know, what you need to do is make sure there's no ants. You need to displace the aphids off the tree, introduce the lace wings, and off you go. And that was the beginning of a long friendship with him. And of course, when the inspector came back, when the ag county inspector came back, he didn't find any aphids. And his first question was, you haven't been back to buy any more.
You're ruining my business.
Yeah, you're ruining my business. And I said, well, kind of smiling, well, come take a look. And he couldn't find any aphids to speak of. And so he asked what did I do? And I explained to him, and he was a pretty good guy. You know, looking back, it sort of looks kind of odd, but he was teaching a class at the junior college on pest control and nematodes and a whole bunch of stuff. And he said, well, you need to go back to school. And he said, come to my class. And that was the beginning of me going back to school. Ultimately, I sold the nursery, used the money to go back to college, and went through his classes and finished degree at Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo in soils and plant pathology. But that was that's what made me aware of the issues about pesticides and wanting to do something about it and growing food organically was there wasn't any available. You couldn't find organic food at the time.
So from there to now, Del Cabo, Sandra, where were you in that time? Like, where's your passion originating from, or your understanding of the earth?
Yeah, okay. Well, my story's a little different. I had been living in cities. Probably around that time, I was in Kansas or Missouri, and then I went out to San Francisco. I'd never been out to the West Coast. And what I noticed myself doing in San Francisco is seeking out the green areas. And I'd go everywhere on my bicycle to get out of the city, even though I was living in the city. And an opportunity came up to work on an Amish farm in Pennsylvania. And at the last minute, that fell through. And then another, I had a friend that was working in a farm in Maine as an apprentice. And so I wrote to the people with that farm and requested that I could be an apprentice on that farm. That was in Harborside, Maine, at Elliott and Sue Coleman's. And that's where Larry and I met. He had come with a friend from California and was working at Helen and Scott Nearing's. So we both ended up camping out in a common campground. And we were the two people that came somewhat ill-prepared to spend the entire summer. We didn't bring a tent or anything. Larry was sort of sleeping in the back of a pickup with his friend. And I had come on a bicycle, so I didn't even have a tent or anything. And that's...
So a couple of those names for our listeners out there. Elliot Coleman is author of many, many books on organic farming, Four Season Harvest, has been celebrated at different farming conferences throughout the nation. He's a keynote speaker. And the Nearings were well known for their Back to the Land movement books that they had. If you were in the 60s and the 50s, I know that they were that very. I'm not even sure if Helen. I know her husband's not alive anymore, but
no, Helen died.
Helen did too. Yes, Scott Nearing was.
Scott Nearing lived to be 100.
Okay, and so if you don't know of these names that Sandra is bringing up, it's worth looking into. Definitely. They definitely were some early pioneers in the organic and the back to the land movement. Very, very, very cool.
And then you started to you found your own farm. You found some land in California.
Well, we were living in a little A-frame cabin, no heat, no running water. It was the December of 1976. It was one of the coldest winters on record. The Penobscot Bay had snow on the beach. There was ice forming in the bay. You go outside and pee. The pee turned to ice on the way to, before it hit the ground. I decided from being from California.
That is cold.
It was time to leave.
Yeah, the Southern California boy thought, let's head south.
Yeah, let's move.
And she was, still is pretty sexy, and I thought the best way to rope her in was to invite her on a venture. So we had a couple of bicycles. We thought, I knew she liked to bike. I said, let's bike down to Central America. I had a job offer in Costa Rica. We didn't get very far in the bicycles because it was so cold, but we bought an old rusted out station wagon for a few hundred dollars, which we ended up selling for a few hundred dollars more than we paid for it in Texas, and then headed on south on our bicycles and got as far as Guatemala, where we got sidetracked by a Welshman who invited us to work its little experimental station. It was an NGO, a non-governmental organization. We ended up becoming in charge of this thing. We didn't know that he was planning on leaving and dumping this whole little gambit of activities. We became very involved in developing and building fuel-saving cook stoves out of earthen materials that save firewood and got smoke out of people's kitchens. Interestingly enough, comes around, you're seeing these same things in the news today. The problem of 30 years ago hasn't gone away. People are still suffering from smoke and open fires in their cooking spaces, and the issue of firewood has become more pronounced than it was when we were young.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Talk about your farm in California. How did you find that land, and what are you growing? You're currently growing both in California as well as Mexico.
Yeah, well, so a couple of things. One was when we were in Guatemala, one of the main activities was a soil testing lab, which we got some money from the Canadian government to start up. And because of my degree in soils, the Welshman who we met, who had invited us to come down there, heard they had this degree in soils, so said, come down to this, you know, help us with this. But that experience of doing the soil testing and recommendations for in the Western Highlands of Guatemala for hundreds of small-scale indigenous Native American farmers left me with this feeling of, you know, how can I be making these recommendations and not having had the experience, not really doing it myself? I had the nursery experience prior to that, but it just didn't seem the same. And I began this idea of having our own farm. And so at some point, Sandra and I went back to California, began looking for a farm. My sister lived in Santa Cruz. The area in Pescadero had these rich alluvial coastal valley soils, clay loam soils. The town of Pescadero seemed like one of those places that's not going to become urbanized because of the local coastal plans. Some of the other political things that were going on in the area, it just seemed like a perfect spot to be, and ended up the place where we set down roots and started this, what was a very small farm, 8 acres in this little coastal valley, growing artichokes, fava beans, dryland farming, peas on the hills, broccoli, elephant garlic, all kinds of stuff. And
you're listening to An Organic Conversation here on Green 960. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today with the studio with us is Larry Jacobs and Sandra Bellin, co-founders of Jacobs Farm Del Cabo, a cooperative of organic growers that addresses not just environmental sustainability, but social and economic sustainability as well. Larry, we just heard from you and Sandra about the beginnings. And did you buy that farmland in Pescadero right away? Or what? Were you clear that you would be organic farmers, Sandra? Was that...
Yes, I mean that was a given that we were not going to use any chemical fertilizers or pesticides, and I'm not. The term organic did exist, but there wasn't really a certification system. The beginnings of it were
we're
starting
1980 at this point, right?
The certification system was farmers visiting other farmers and. And it was a great way to learn about what other people were doing.
Sure.
We remember going and visiting some of the neighboring farms down Santa Cruz, and we'd get some ideas from them, and they'd come up and see what we were doing. And you sign a little paragraph that says, I swear on a stack of backhoes and shovels that we're farming organically, and that was it.
So farming organically according to what? To what standards?
There weren't any standards at that time that was what...
You were just anything harmful. Like, there must have been a definition if you would swear that it was organic by...
There were sort of the pre-standards back then. I think it was referred to as the standards. I think it was 1989 versus 1990. I don't know what the name of that was.
Yeah, because I know CCUF was formed in 1973. Right.
And yeah.
There must have, you
so
know,
they
there
had
was a,
it wasn't there weren't
a
national
rough
standards
guide of what it means to be an organic farmer.
Those
excluding anything toxic.
Right. Basically, it was no toxic chemicals and no chemical fertilizers. That's what was coming out of this group of growers who were farming without these materials, out of a commitment that, you know, we want to eat food that doesn't have these pesticides on it. We're going to make it available. It's not available. There's nobody doing it. It was very much considered a fringe activity, dismissed by the rest of the agricultural community at the time. I remember a neighbor telling me, you're the kid growing the stuff organically. The darn, I put it on my cereal. It doesn't hurt me. And, you know, 25 years later, the same now elderly man says, hey, how do I get my farm certified?
Yeah, great. We've come far. And back then, farmers were certifying each other. Signing on the dotted line. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Helberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we will be right back after a short break.
Way down here, you need a reason to move. Feel a fool, running your stateside games, lose your load.
My name is Earl Herrick, and I am the owner of Earl's Organic Produce, a San Francisco Bay Area distributor fully committed to organic produce. From the time one could find organic fruits and vegetables only in natural food stores to now, when schools and fine restaurants feature organic, we have been forging relationships with growers for over 20 years. If you want to offer the finest organic produce to your employees or customers, find us at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Have you heard of Local Dirt? It's the new online site for finding, selling, and buying local food. LocalDirt.com features local farms, their stores, photos, and lists everything local farmers grow and produce. Find local products in your area, in your region, or anywhere in the U.S. Want to find a farmer's market or get together with your friends and start a buying club? Local Dirt does all that at no charge. Go local with Local Dirt. Find out more at LocalDirt.com.
LocalDirt.com is a project funded by the National Science Foundation in support of local agriculture and local communities.
Sungevity wants solar energy to be available to everyone. It's that simple. And with the new Sungevity Solar Lease, it can be. The Sungevity Solar Lease makes it easy to power your home with clean, renewable energy and save money every month, all with no money down and low monthly payments over 10 years. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Frye Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Frye never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Frye organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Frye Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines, without added sulfites, available at grocery stores and online at fryewine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
For the ultimate West Marin experience, visit Toby's Feed Barn in Point Reyes Station, home of the Point Reyes Farmers Market every Saturday. Toby's Feed Barn features organic produce, native plants, gifts, books, an organic coffee bar, an art gallery, concerts, even daily yoga classes. Toby's Feed Barn in downtown Point Reyes Station. Open 7 days a week. Family owned and operated since 1942. A West Marin original. For more information, visit tobysfeedbarn.com. Marin Organic, an association of organic food producers in Marin County, California, is helping to create a healthy and sustainable food shed just north of the Golden Gate Bridge. A model for how to feed a region in a way that is economically viable, environmentally sound, socially just, and culturally appropriate. The opportunity to change the world is right on our plates. Be a part of the solution. For more information on Marin Organic and how to support its efforts, visit marinorganic.org.
We are back here to An Organic Conversation on Green 960. I'm Helge Helberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today we are talking about an entire sustainable family, the family of Del Carbo. With us in the studio are the founders of Del Carbo, Larry Jacobs and Sandra Bellin. Del Carbo is a cooperative of organic growers that addresses environmental sustainability as well as social and economic responsibility.
So Larry and Sandra, you know, I've driven that stretch of the coastline where Pescadero is and where your farm is and worked in Santa Cruz, and you are well known nationally for the beautiful herbs that you grow and different things like that. And I would think that most people would be satisfied with settling in and and in this beautiful small town and growing great herbs and serving and feeding their community. But you have taken it beyond that. You tell us a little bit about Del Cabo, how that all, what led you to leave Pescadero and start something down there?
Well, I think it was, I'm not sure what, it was probably the winter of 74 or 75, no, 84, 85. And Helen Nearing had come out to visit, I guess shortly after, a year or so after Scott had died. And we were cleaning elephant garlic, and she was planning on going down to Barra de Navidad in, not sure the state, in Mexico. It's on the coast on the mainland of Mexico. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And somehow one thing led to the other, and we found ourselves driving this funky old Honda, her and us, all the way down to Barra de Navidad and doing this workshop with her. And we left her there after about a week or so and crossed over on the ferry to the tip of the Baja. And we immediately fell in love with the area. And we passed through a little town on the west side, and it was called Pescadero. And suddenly, bingo, we go, wow, let's do Pescadero South. We have Pescadero North and Pescadero South. And we drove on up the Baja, and we got back, and we immediately started talking to the people that were buying our Pescadero produce, like Veritable Vegetable, Santa Cruz Trucking, mm-hmm. and Earl's. I don't know if Earl's even existed yet.
85, maybe just getting started.
Anyway, so we talked to a variety of people, and they gave a thumbs up. There was nobody doing organic produce in the winter months.
Mm-hmm. Was that difficult? Like starting a second farm in Mexico in the beginning of the 80s? Why the idea of a collaborative? Was that right from the get-go? Why did you choose that business model?
You know, we saw when we were down there the first time, we saw that there were these little tiny patchwork postage stamp size farms. And these families were growing, you know, they'd have cilantro, they'd have a few tomatoes, they'd have some cabbage. And their problem was when one guy had cilantro, everybody had cilantro. When one person, they all had the same things at the same time.
As we do here.
As we do here. Yeah. And so when you would drive into the town of San Jose del Cabo, just on the outskirts of the town was a population sign. It said 10,000. That was probably a gross exaggeration. There wasn't the tourism that we think of as that part of the world today. It was a sleepy little agricultural ag town.
Yeah, 10,000 means so far until then.
And so far. Yeah. and then we had this experience that we had in Central America working with thousands of these people in the highlands. Mm-hmm. And that was, at a very deep level, very satisfying. The feelings that when you saw that you were doing something that was productive and really helpful for people, and they'd occasionally thank you, and that was, you know, made it really worthwhile. So there was that piece missing in the farming that we're doing in California, that part where you were helping people. And we both saw an opportunity to...
And be part of a true culture.
To be part of a true culture. And what we saw that was wrong with the development work, the nonprofit work that we were doing, was it was dependent upon writing grants, continually getting funding. And we were struck by that was not the best way to do these kinds of programs where you were raising people's standard of living and income and creating more economic choices. The way to do it was to create
businesses,
to create businesses that they ran and owned that had potential to grow, and that would bring income into the community. At the same time, it was an opportunity for teaching and for bringing more information into these towns. And that's where we went with it.
So with your background, it makes sense to see that. How difficult was it to convince locals to enter into a cooperative? Because there's, you know, Mexican pride in families that are generations and generations old that maybe are not used to do business with, you know, one another. What are the obstacles, and how were you able to overcome those, or was it an easy walk?
We started by writing a one-half-page, single-space-typed project. We called it a project. And we presented that to the local government official. It was the
Director of Rural Development.
Right, Minister of Rural Development, or Director of Rural. So he was in this little corner office, dingy, dark, you know, dusty. Who knew? We had no idea what he did, but we were directed to him. We gave him our little one-page thing, and he said, "Oh, I know just the guy to introduce you to. It sounds like a great idea." And he introduced us to the fellow who was the president of the local farming group there, which is called Ejido. And that became a turned into a meeting with eight was supposed to be 10, but was eight individuals in who listened and were willing to give it a try. They had said during the meeting, "Well, our fathers and our grandfathers had farmed without chemicals. You know, we might as well give this a shot. We have nothing to lose."
So that was the directive in your outline. You said
they
it would
be
organic.
They were also organic by default.
Oh, yeah.
They wouldn't buy pesticides.
They wanted to use them, you know, they would, but they didn't have the money to buy them.
Sure.
So there was this, like Senator said, default organic farming going on by these people that were pretty poor. Their annual income was $1,000, $3,000 a year. What we didn't know was that when we left the room, there was an enormous skepticism. We found out like 5 years later that they were saying to themselves, "This is impossible," because there's been a lot of promotion about the pesticides and the way to farm to make this thing work. And they just said, you know, these guys don't have any idea of the problems of growing things down here. And of course we didn't.
But why did they sign on anyway?
Because of the poverty, because there wasn't any market for the things they were doing, because they had, interestingly, there was an individual came just before us the year before, whose first name was Larry. His last name was Elmer, who was introduced to them, to the same group of individuals, but in a larger context. He was introduced by the local mayor, and he had, you know, gold chain and a gold rings, and he obviously had a lot of money, and he was going to buy all their mangoes and avocados, and they loaded up a truck and sent it up to the States, and he said, "Great," and send another one. They sent another one. It was small, not a big truck, a small truck. And then he gave him a check. And the check was bounced all the way to the stratosphere. And they never were to get the money from him. And we showed up, you know, I don't know if it was how many months after him. Here's a guy with the same first name as me. It was pretty amazing that they even were willing to try
right.
this. But when I heard about, you know, after 3 or 4 months, they had enough confidence. Our Spanish was at the very country Spanish, and I suspect that was part of what was
appealing,
helped, appealing yeah. and broke down some of the barriers. You know, we weren't very, you know, we didn't pretend like we knew what we were doing. One of the first things we had learned in Central America and some of the other places we worked is locals know more than you do. The first thing you do is you listen, learn as much as you can, just assume they got it figured out, and your ideas aren't going to work here.
Yes, what a great philosophy for life anyway.
That's right.
To listen. Actually, you are listening to An Organic Conversation here on Green 960. I'm Helge Helberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we're talking with Larry Jacobs and Sandra Bellin, the co-founders of Del Cabo, a cooperative in Mexico of organic growers that address environmental, economical, and social sustainability. So you got those eight, and how many acres are we talking about? We got eight farmers in Mexico convinced to try it.
They started with about an acre each. The first, we grew everything under the sun. The big success was the summer squashes, zucchinis, the sunburst squashes. Mark may remember that. And there was a...
That's 8 acres to begin with. That's
yeah,
a,
well,
that's
it seemed
a decent
like a,
size, you know, small, but for organic... Standards. It's an average size.
Yeah, well, it was comparable to what we were doing in California and what became all the culinary herbs. And we still have the first piece of paper of the first shipment. It was like 52 cases. We've loaded up on an airplane. That was part of the head scratcher, is how do you get something from the tip of the Baja all the way up to the Bay Area? And we realized, oh, these airplanes are basically, they're flying down here and they're going back empty. Basically empty. And so that was the epiphany. Had some problems because the first shipment, we had these old leftover mango boxes, and we took the wood from the mango boxes and hammered them together into little small slats, and that's what we packed up the first vegetables in, and cherry tomatoes and everything else. And when they got to the airport, Sandra was up here to meet them, and the guys at the airport said, "Oh, you guys are the ones with the tomatoes all over the bottom of the plane." And they had to go pick the stuff off the plane, and Sandra had to show up with a hammer and some nails every time we sent a shipment and hammer these boxes back together. There was a learning curve.
Wow. And how about the, you know, bringing in produce from a foreign country to the U.S. Was that easy, or were customs used to that? You had to go through customs, right?
You had to go through customs. You had to have a USDA inspection. You had periodically an FDA inspection. But things have changed a lot since then. We had a lot of support and help from the people who were there. The USDA inspector said, you know, gave us some tips. You know, here's what you guys got to know about. Here are the problems. Everyone was helpful in teaching us what the ropes were. The guys at the airlines.
Right. We were flying on Mexicana Airlines and then later on Alaska, and people were just bent over backwards to help. We met different people in customs, different people in the USDA, and everybody was very supportive to help make this go. Likewise in Mexico as well. It was very a small town feel of what was going on in San Jose del Cabo and in the San Francisco airport. And nowadays, it's dramatically different.
Everybody got that this was a project that we're working on to help.
Pioneering effort.
And we're trying to help these families succeed. We were using a metrics, what was their annual income. We succeeded in getting it from around 3,000 up to 30,000 with a range of some guys making more and some guys making less. But that was a pretty successful number for families. And I just remember the head of customs in Mexico. I was so worried about going to see this guy. And I didn't know what to expect. And he was an elderly man in one of these classic old offices. He had these big keys, skeleton keys to open up his door. They used to have the typewriter standing up on edges. The typewriters had cobwebs, and it was like, who knows what these guys were doing. I was expecting, you know, he's going to hit me up for some big bribe. And so I gave him my spiel and what we were doing and what we were trying to do. And he listened, and he goes, "This is great." So he stood up from his desk. He's holding up both fists. "Just come back when you're ready." "So what do I need to do?" "Just come back a couple hours before you're going to ship, and we'll take care of everything." Wow. And it turns out he was...
You were the only customer.
We were the only guys doing any exporting out. There was nothing else happening.
You were his job security.
And this is Don Arturo. He's a man that was in his 70s.
But he would tell us stories about in the 40s when they used to grow tomatoes out of that area and load them on boats and send them up to Los Angeles and the Bay Area. And he just felt like this was was a wonderful thing, and this bring this back.
You need to tell about the old typewriter and typing up that form.
He always wanted me to get there, you know, several hours early, and he would take five pieces of paper and four pieces of carbon, slip this into the typewriter, roll it up. They were blank, by the way. And he'd begin making this form using an M, small letter M, to create the boxes and the date and he created this whole form with two fingers. This would take hours. I was supposed to get then to the airlines and then back to the airport and load this stuff. There was a timeline here. And he would, every time I'd show up, he'd type up this whole form, these five pieces of paper. So one day I decided, darn, he's making the same form. I whited out all the information. This was a provisionary export or form of some kind,
sure.
Certificate. I whited it all out, and I Xeroxed it. And I made a bunch of copies of it. And then I just gave, the next time I came in, I gave it to him, and he looked at it and he goes, what's this? I said, now you just have to type in, you know, 400 kilos and 430 sure. boxes and
it'll
the date.
Save you a lot of time.
And you'll save you a lot of time. And he looked at me.
But he felt really old at that moment.
Well, no.
Technology.
He said, well, then we won't have time to talk.
I love it.
It was the stories. Yeah, he had these stories that he loved to tell the story. And he wanted to hear about what was happening on the farms. And his face just fell. You know, we won't have time to talk. I made a point of showing up early and talking, realizing that was important. That was a big lesson to me.
Yeah.
That there was other things going on besides.
What we do is just the opportunity for an invitation to talk.
Wow.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation here on Green 960. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we'll be right back hearing more about the Del Cabo story when we come back right after the break.
Heard of Local Dirt? LocalDirt.com is the new online marketplace, your site to buy, sell, find, and feature local produce and products. Start a buying club, sign up for a local CSA or box program in your area, or purchase the freshest and healthiest local products your region has to offer directly from the farm, anywhere you live. LocalDirt.com, your place for local food.
LocalDirt.com is a project funded by the National Science Foundation in support of local agriculture and local communities.
Frey Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Frey never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Frey organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Frey Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines, without added sulfites, available at grocery stores and online at freywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Are you a business or a restaurant looking for the finest organic produce for your employees or customers? Earl's Organic Produce is a San Francisco Bay Area distributor fully committed to organic produce. Earl's has been building relationships with organic growers locally and beyond the Bay Area since 1988. So Earl's offers the ability to choose produce from many growers of all sizes throughout the changing seasons. For the finest organic produce, visit earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Hi, I'm Peter Walsh. My wife and I founded Manika Jewelry with the intention to offer a different kind of jewelry. Beautiful, made by local Bay Area artists, and without a social or environmental compromise. Our featured designers use reclaimed precious metals and Kimberly certified gemstones. It's jewelry made with heart and soul. Come visit our store just off Union Square at 11 Maiden Lane in San Francisco, or visit our website at manikajewelry.com.
Are you looking for a romantic and unusual location in the Bay Area for your wedding or upcoming anniversary? Toby's Feed Barn offers the perfect venue for your celebration. A rustic barn in the heart of beautiful West Marin, with local organic caterers ready to delight your guests amid bales of hay. Toby's Feed Barn in downtown Point Reyes Station. Open 7 days a week. Family owned and operated since 1942. A West Marin original. For more information, visit tobysfeedbarn.com.
And we are back to An Organic Conversation as part of the Green Morning here in Green 960, an entire morning dedicated to your health, holistic nutrition, eco-travel, and food advocacy. The Green Morning every Saturday from 9 to 12:30 on Green 960. For more information, visit thegreenmorning.com. www.earlsorganicproduce.com. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today we're talking about the sustainable family Jacobs Farm Del Cabo, a cooperative of organic growers that address environmental, social, and economical responsibility. With us in the studio right now is Larry Jacobs and Sandra Bellin, the co-founders of Jacobs Farm Del Cabo.
So what's changed? When we just before the break, you were telling us that wonderful story about the forms and the M's and just, you know, how you began. But so what's changed? You know, bring us up to where we are today.
So we started with about 8 acres, and it's grown from those 8 families to about 400 families, several thousand acres. Now it's gone all up and down the Baja. We've not quite cookie cutter, but we've copied the model that worked so successfully with a group in the South, with other groups up and down the other communities, in part working with the governor, who was, when we first started, was this minister of social
rural development
in the county of San Jose. Today, in this little dingy office today, he's the governor of the state. And when he became governor, he contacted us and asked if we would work with their rural development program to they would identify communities that were
in need, had
economic problems. And then we go in with a team of guys, figure out if this would work, and then provide the expertise, the teaching,
that's great,
the background to get this thing going. So it's there's now 8 of these things, one over on the mainland, and a whole network of growers and these grower groups and owned by the farmers all up and down the Baja Peninsula.
Wonderful.
So when people are buying your cherry tomatoes and basil all across the country, I'm sure people are familiar with the not only your herbs from Jacobs Farm, but also from the Del Cabo product. They're literally directly supporting those farmers.
That money's going to those farmers and the communities of those farmers. In many cases, it's their kids and cousins and relatives that are helping with the packing and with the truck driving and all the auxiliary stuff that goes along with making these farms work.
So we often get calls or emails from listeners asking about organic certification in other countries. How is it done in Mexico? If you buy, in your case, a Del Cabo tomato and it says certified organic, it has to be organic up to USDA, United States organic standards. How is that being done in Mexico?
So when we started, when there was just 8 of us, and we were started doing it the same way we started in California.
You just called it that.
We went around to each guy, and you had to sign a little paragraph that swore on a stack of shovels that you were doing it organically the way we were talking about. But it really was a process of teaching people about growing food with nature, with insects, the complexity of agroecosystems. And when we first started, the ag extension workers that were the government workers that work for the Mexican Ministry of Agriculture, they came behind me telling these guys, you got to spray this, you got to spray that. They'd see insects on something, and they say, you got to deal with it, you got to spray this chemical. And I end up having, and the guys would come up and say, what do we do? They're going to give us a fine. I say, calm down. Just do it the way we're talking about it. Remember what we're learning about these different insects. And I went in to meet with the director of the Ministry of Agriculture in that town and said, look, we got a problem. You guys are coming out and telling our guys to spray these things. Here's what we're doing. We're doing this without these chemicals. We're nurturing this agroecosystem, and you're destroying. You just won't work. And so what are you talking about? So, well, there's biological control. What's biological control? Oh, wait. I got an idea. Why don't we provide a class? And so we set up, so I'd come in every Saturday morning, and all the agronomists for this little county, they'd all come in, and I gave them this class. So we taught them about beneficial insects, and we taught them about
crop rotation,
soil health, and biological control. What I didn't know came out of it is how these guys started out going around doing what I was doing. I sort of multiplied myself without even knowing it.
Wow.
They now began helping because they now understood what, how this was working. They were pretty excited about it.
So within those families that you started to work with, how much local knowledge about those things was still there? Because, you know, you said they didn't have the money to buy pesticides and chemicals to begin with. How were they doing it? There must have been, you know, some basis of local knowledge of...
They had some interesting tricks up their sleeves, like the rabbit infestation.
Rabbits?
Yeah, rabbit infestation. Right. So what are we going to do about the rabbits? You know? And they came up with a saying where they would set out these little cans with sand in them with some kerosene or something that would burn, and they'd set these little lamps up out in the fields at night, and that helped deter the rabbits. You know, the insects, we came in with a trick, of grandma, a little tiny wasp we were able to get from not too far away, and we do this trick of grandma releases, and then we were able to get Bacillus thuringiensis was available at that time, a bacteria that's used that makes insects sick. So between the releases of these insects and the Bacillus thuringiensis in the little tomato patches, they saw that they stopped having worm problems in their corn. Well, they weren't doing anything in the corn, but the corn was nearby, and that was the first milagro, first miracle. Uh-huh. Holy shit! Something's really working here, and people became quickly convinced. And what was really satisfying was when we would take visitors to see some of the farms, and some of these third grade educated guys would explain about, you know, here's a lace wing and here's a big eyed bug, and you know, these are the beneficial insects, and we've got this planting of cilantro and corn here in the middle, so that creates a place for these insects to live. We're creating these pollen sources. And I began to understand that these guys were really getting it. They were getting what biological control was about. They were getting how you create a healthy ecosystem. They got the point that you needed diversification, and they were explaining it to other people. It didn't matter that they only had a third grade education. They understood what was going on, and Sandra and I realized we had made a change.
So from then to now, from no standards to now defined 2002 USDA organic standards, how since 2002 and bringing in produce now?
When the NOP, what was it, 1998, yeah. When the Organic Food Production Act was first signed, that mandated USDA to create standards, and the standards, the National Organic Program came through in 2002, something like that.
Yeah, 1990 and 2002, yeah.
When certification became more formalized, we chose Oregon Tilth, which is a independent organic certifier in the state of Oregon, partly because they had a good reputation. They were open to certifying something out of the country, which was unusual at the time. And they sent down two individuals to do the certification, one who was a bilingual individual and the other one who was a grower and one of their inspectors.
This was in the early 90s, Lars.
Yeah, that was in the early 90s. That's mm-hmm. right.
Yeah, so it was before the
federal standards.
Before the federal standards. These guys hit the ground, you know, running from dawn to dusk. They were in the fields. They show back up the hotel covered with dirt. They were really... They looked at every single field, and when they saw all the work that was involved, what they were doing, it wasn't long afterward we decided to hire one of them. We offered one of them a job, a fellow by the name of John Graham, who still works with us.
Well, that's a conflict of interest.
Yeah, we hired him to organize and to manage the paperwork and do the training. And what we felt we needed was we needed an internal group of young agronomists, Mexican agronomists, who understood the regulations and could have a continual process of explaining and teaching and promoting this thing. And that's what he took on. He trained a group of guys, and he still works with them and does some mentoring. And we now have a team who checks, and we're constantly monitoring on the ground in the field. We don't depend upon the annual inspection that's done by Oregon Tilth today.
But so right now when you see produce from Mexico, Del Cabo or not, it is as certified as any organic product here in the United States. You have an annual inspection people actually coming down from wherever your certifier is at.
It has to comply with the same regulations.
And they literally come down, fly down, check your fields, inspect how your operation runs, what you use, what you don't use.
And Oregon Tilt does a very thorough job. They go to every field.
Wow. And that's every year.
There's a lot of fields.
That's every year. So they've got to go to 400 fields. Wow. And these are little tiny fields.
And that's every single year, 400 fields.
Every single year.
And so, 400 fields means 400 families, right?
That means 400 families.
Wow.
Wow. So we're just about out of time, but I would just like to, I've just been enthralled in your stories. I've been sitting back in my chair just loving this this hour of your stories. So what are you hopeful for? What makes you hopeful at this time in your life?
The young people today, the public voting with their forks, and the incredible growth in demand for organics, the awareness about pesticides and what that means, this resurgence of interest in food, those are all great indicators. And as we're heading towards the last lap of our careers, to see this incredible energy, and especially amongst the young people, is terribly satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Sandra, how about you?
Yeah, even high school kids. There's a great program in Santa Cruz called Food What? And it brings high school students into the field and teaches them leadership and self-esteem through learning to cook food and grow food.
At Jacobs Farm?
No, this is a program through Life Lab up at the university. But it's amazing how much interest there is in agriculture and food, even at the high school age.
Wonderful.
Great.
Well, thank you for joining us today and for sharing the 30 plus years of, from a trip from Guatemala all the way to running 2,000 acres, or working with 400 family farms, farming 2,000 acres in Mexico. And you were really the first who brought in produce in an organized fashion to California, is that right? And to actually throughout the entire United States at this point. That had not been done before.
There wasn't anyone doing it before then. It was, there were conventional growers growing in Mexico for that winter window. This was a novel idea at the time.
And it turned into what it is today, Jacobs Farm Del Cabo. Larry Jacobs, founder, and Sandra Bellin, founders of Del Cabo Jacobs Farm. Thanks for joining us today and sharing your story. Beautiful. An Organic Conversation is produced by our amazing Jen Lloyd, production assistant, the outstanding Gina Restani. Underwriting production provided by The Ear, the one and only Mark Van Gelder. Thank you all, and also always thanks to the team here at Green 960, our very own Fab Four, Corey Calvert, Mark McNone, Robert Costa, and Ricky Ferrer. And also always thanks to our listeners for being part of this show and for actually listening.
For our blogs, podcasts, and more information on this show and previous shows, please visit our website at anorganicconversation.com. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can download An Organic Conversation to your iPhone or iPod, so you can listen to Helga and I wherever and whenever you want to.
You may also follow us on Facebook and Twitter and many other social media services. Always look for An Organic Conversation, and we love to hear from you. Please send us your comments and questions to share@anorganicconversation.com. All this is part of The Green Morning, an entire morning dedicated to your health. The Green Morning, every Saturday from 9 to 12:30 here on Green 960. For more information, visit thegreenmorning.com. Coming up right here after the hour, as part of The Green Morning, is Your Supernatural Life with Beth Greer, a fantastic show on how to live a healthier, less toxic life. So please stay tuned. We're your hosts, Helga Hellberg.
And Mark Mulcahy.
And we'll be back right here next Saturday at 10 a.m. Have a great weekend. And thanks again for listening to An Organic Conversation here on Green 960. I'll stop before I can stop, or before I see things the right way up.